Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. I know many people feel like we are entering a dark time, but for the benefit of us all, I hope that is not the case.
As Kamala Harris concedes to Donald Trump, we'll look at the roots of Trump's victory. Bernie Sanders blames the Democrats for abandoning the working class. We'll speak to UCLA professor Robin D.G. Kelly, as well as journalist Fatima Bhutto. We'll talk about the global implications of Trump's return to the White House. Plus, we'll look at Trump's vow to deport millions of immigrants.
As soon as I take the oath of office, I'll terminate every open border policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
And we'll speak with Professor Anura Kalminyan, author of In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Kamala Harris has conceded the 2024 presidential race to Donald Trump, promising a peaceful transfer of power. Harris addressed supporters Wednesday afternoon at her alma mater, Howard University, after calling Trump to congratulate him.
In our nation, we owe loyalty not to a president or a party, but to the Constitution of the United States. And loyalty to our conscience and to our God. My allegiance to all three is why I am here to say, while I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign. This is not a time to throw up our hands. This is a time to roll up our sleeves.
With millions of ballots still to be counted, Trump is expected to match the 74 million votes he received in 2020. Kamala Harris, meanwhile, won just 68 million votes so far, lagging far behind Joe Biden's performance in 2020 when he got 81 million votes. The vast majority of the 3,000-plus counties across the United States, whether urban, suburban, or rural, swung right in this year's election. Control over the House of Representatives remains up for grabs, with dozens of races yet to be called. So far, Republicans have claimed 206 House seats compared to Democrats' 191. Whichever party reaches 218 will hold the majority and can determine who becomes House Speaker. Meanwhile, Republicans have increased their control over the Senate after winning a majority of seats for the first time since 2020. In Montana, incumbent Democratic Senator John Tester has lost his reelection bid, flipping another Senate seat for Republicans. He was defeated by Tim Sheehy, a former Navy SEAL endorsed by Donald Trump. Sheehy gets an A rating from the National Rifle Association, is strongly anti-abortion. Earlier this year, Montana's Charcuta News published audio clips of Sheehy at campaign events making racist and highly offensive comments about Native Americans. In Nevada, Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen will hold on to her seat after fending off a challenge from Republican Sam Brown. Rosen's a former synagogue president, first elected to the Senate in 2018. In Michigan, Democratic Congressmember Alyssa Slotkin has narrowly won an open U.S. Senate seat, defeating Republican Mike Rogers. Slotkin's a former Middle East analyst for the CIA who served three terms in Iraq under George W. Bush. She also worked as a high-ranking Pentagon official under President Obama. Puerto Rico's non-voting member of Congress, Republican Jennifer Gonzalez, is set to become the island's next governor. She's a supporter of statehood for Puerto Rico and a Trump supporter. She's on track to narrowly beat Juan Dalmau of the Alianza Coalition. The center-left third-party group made history gains in this year's election, with Puerto Rican voters disaffected with the two main parties. The world's richest person, Elon Musk, saw his net worth soar by over $16 billion Wednesday after Donald Trump secured victory. His net worth is now estimated at $290 billion. Musk personally spent about $120 million helping Trump get elected and used his social media site X, formerly Twitter, to promote Trump's campaign. On Tuesday, Musk wrote, quote, "Men are voting in record numbers. They now realize everything is at stake." Musk was echoing Republican talking points aimed at countering Kamala Harris's support among women and voter dissatisfaction with abortion bans. Trump vowed to install Musk as head of a new government efficiency commission. Musk has proposed cuts of at least $2 trillion to federal spending. Meanwhile, CNN and Politico are reporting Trump has tapped Brian Hook, a top State Department official during the first Trump administration, to begin staffing the State Department. Hook served as special envoy for Iran under Trump, leading the maximum pressure campaign of sanctions, sabotage, and assassinations against Tehran. Special Counsel Jack Smith is reportedly preparing to wind down his two federal criminal cases against Donald Trump in line with Justice Department policy that shields a sitting president from prosecution. Smith charged Trump with election subversion and illegally retaining classified documents. During campaigning, Trump said he would fire Smith within 2 seconds if he was reelected. Meanwhile, Trump's lawyers are expected to ask New York Judge Juan Merchan to delay sentencing in Trump's New York hush money and election interference trial. Trump's sentencing on 34 felony counts was postponed earlier this year to November 26th. Georgia's sweeping election subversion case against Trump is also at risk of being delayed due to his reelection. Immigrant communities across the U.S. and asylum seekers near the U.S. border are trying to figure out what an incoming Trump administration will mean for their safety and their rights. This is immigrant rights activist Jose Garcia, who works with asylum seekers in Tijuana.
For us, the concerns here in the north is that the migrant communities will be stuck. However, we will also see many migrants wanting to cross irregularly based on the fact that these aid programs are going to be removed. People will risk more to want to cross irregularly at the various points in our border areas. It is a latent risk where they can be robbed, assaulted, where they can be abandoned to their fate, and in a moment, they can even lose their lives.
We'll have more on immigration later in the broadcast with Stanford professor Ana Raquel Minyan. The Israeli military says Palestinians from northern Gaza will not be allowed to return to their homes, effectively admitting to ethnically cleansing the region. A military official said any future aid to Gaza would only be allowed to enter through the south, but not the north, where there are, quote, no more civilians left, unquote. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Wateridge posted a harrowing video from northern Gaza showing its utter decimation. Wateridge wrote, quote, "No matter from what direction you enter, homes, hospitals, schools, health clinics, mosques, apartments, restaurants, all completely flattened. An entire society now a graveyard." Unquote. This comes as the head of UNRWA warned once again the agency will collapse, quote, without intervention by member states. Reuters reports the UN suggested in a letter to Israel that replacing the aid provided by UNRWA would become Israel's responsibility after it recently cut ties with the UN agency. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization resumed large-scale medical evacuations Wednesday, moving over 100 critical patients out of Gaza. Fewer than 300 patients had been able to leave Gaza since Israel blocked the Rafah crossing in May. The WHO estimates up to 14,000 Palestinians are in need of urgent medical evacuation from Gaza. Israeli attacks on Gaza have killed at least 27 Palestinians since the day started, including at least 3 children in Rafah. In Lebanon, residents of Beirut woke up to smoke-filled skies this morning after a night of Israeli bombardment targeting the capital's southern neighborhoods. This followed deadly Israeli strikes on the eastern Bekaa Valley and the city of Baalbek, which killed at least 40 people and wounded 50 on Wednesday. Hezbollah said it launched a series of attack drones at the Bilu military base south of Tel Aviv in response to the latest attacks. Lebanese residents of Beirut continue to condemn Israel's escalating assault on Lebanon.
This is a savage, predatory enemy that destroys homes, kills people, and kills civilization. It cannot defeat the Hezbollah party. It cannot defeat them with destroying civilizations, with destroying homes, with anything. It cannot defeat them. And I say to Hezbollah, do not stop. Do not stop resisting this enemy. I mean, what is taken away by force must return by force, too.
Meanwhile, Lebanon has filed a complaint at the UN's International Labor Organization over Israel's September terror attack in which 4,000 people were killed or wounded when their pagers suddenly exploded across Lebanon. Russia ratified a mutual defense pact with North Korea Wednesday, solidifying the military alliance between Moscow and Pyongyang. This comes as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned of a, quote, new chapter of instability after revealing his troops fought North Korean soldiers on the battlefield for the first time. The combat reportedly took place earlier this week in Russia's Kursk region, though South Korea downplayed the encounter, labeling it an incident involving a small number of fighters. Ukraine says some 11,000 North Korean soldiers are now stationed in Kursk, where Ukraine launched a surprise counterinvasion in August. Germany's governing coalition collapsed Wednesday after Chancellor Olaf Scholz fired his finance minister following failed talks between the three ruling parties. Scholz said he'll remain in office but called for a confidence vote January 15th, which could lead to fresh elections by the end of March.
I will now very quickly seek a conversation with the opposition leader, Friedrich Merz. I would like to offer him to work constructively together on two issues, or more, which are important for our country, the quick strengthening of our economy and our defense. Our economy can't wait until a snap election takes place.
The Pakistani province of Punjab is asking people to stay home as much as possible, halting in-person schooling and setting up a so-called smog war room in an effort to tackle record levels of air pollution that have choked the region. Hospitals report a spike in patients with respiratory and other smog-related conditions. The air quality index in Lahore recently soared as high as 120 times over recommended levels.
I'm struggling with shortness of breath and watery eyes, likely from poor air quality. I'll stay home until it's safe to venture out.
Government officials say they're investigating ways to mitigate the pollution, including inducing artificial rainfall. This suffocating smog is brought about by a combination of crop burning, vehicular and industrial emissions, and colder air. In Southern California, 14,000 people in Ventura County have been told to evacuate as firefighters battle the fast-moving mountain fire. Nearby, another wildfire, the Broad Fire in Malibu, also erupted Wednesday amidst the dry conditions and strong winds. Forecasters say the rest of the week could bring extremely critical wildfire danger to the region. And Cuba's power grid collapsed again on Wednesday as Hurricane Rafael lashed the island nation with torrential rains and sustained winds of 115 miles per hour. The decades-long U.S.-led embargo on Cuba has left Cuba unable to update its ailing energy infrastructure or import enough fuel and food for its residents. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Kamala Harris has conceded to Donald Trump after the former president pulled off an overwhelming victory Tuesday to send him back to the White House. On Wednesday, Harris spoke at Howard University.
I will never give up the fight for a future where Americans can pursue their dreams, ambitions, and aspirations, where the women of America have the freedom to make decisions about their own body and not have their government telling them what to do. We will never give up the fight to protect our schools and our streets from gun violence. And America, we will never give up the fight for our democracy, for the rule of law, for equal justice, and for the sacred idea that every one of us, no matter who we are or where we start out, has certain fundamental rights and freedoms that must be respected and upheld.
That was Kamala Harris giving her concession speech on Wednesday. The Democratic Party is in a state of crisis after Trump expanded his support across the country and Republicans also regained control of the Senate. Republicans may also keep control of the House.
On Wednesday, independent Senator Bernie Sanders blasted the Democratic Party. In a statement, Sanders said, quote, "It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party, which has abandoned working class people, would find that the working class has abandoned them. While the Democratic leadership defends the status quo, the American people are angry and want change. And they're right," Sanders said. To talk more about Tuesday's election, we're joined by Robin D.G. Kelley, professor of history at UCLA, who studies social movements. He's author of many books, including Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. Professor Kelley, it's great to have you back with us. If you can start off by talking about Donald Trump's major victory, I mean, sweeping the country, actually winning the popular vote as well as what looks like the Electoral College vote, Harris winning far fewer millions of votes than President Biden did in 2020, though some Democrats, for example, Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan, polled much higher and won. She did not get those same votes. And end by talking about what Democratic Senator Sanders is saying, that the Democratic Party has abandoned the working class.
Right. Let's begin with Senator Sanders. He's absolutely right. The Democratic Party abandoned the working class. Kamala Harris ran on a ticket of moving toward the right, you know, shifting, you know, pivoting toward the right, bragging that Liz Cheney is endorsing her. And so there was really no program to focus on the actual suffering of working people across the board. That's true. Now, when we think about 2024 compared to 2020, I'm not sure that Trump's victory is so historic. Trump would have won in 2020 had it not been for the uprisings and that emerged out of the George Floyd murder. The win was behind the Democratic Party, even though the Democratic Party didn't earn that win. And so I think that's a factor. The other factor is that the country is moving toward the right, and the working class or working classes feel really disaffected and abandoned. They feel abandoned, I believe, for a couple of reasons. One, because whatever the numbers said about the shifting in economy, the fact of the matter is that people are still dealing with inflation, with joblessness, with insecurity. But the second thing, and this goes back to an article I published back in 2016, we also have a deeply racist, Islamophobic, xenophobic nation. And that runs through. I mean, when you look at the demographics, white men consistently vote for Trump. White women, of course, there was a slight shift, but the shift wasn't that radical. I mean, I don't trust exit polls, but it's amazing how many white women supported Trump. It's amazing how much of the message of fascism actually did tap into a deep insecurity, a deep fear, and the fact that deportation is the dominant message that is drawing working people. So I really want to talk about the question of class, which I think is most important. We have a class that's suffering, but we don't have a class that thinks of itself as a class. If we had a class that thought of itself as a class, then working people would say, we refuse deportation, we refuse racism, we refuse transphobia, because that's what the class does. Solidarity is what's missing, the sense that we as a class, you know, have to protect each other. Trump is seen as the person who can fix things, the person who represents the CEO who could step in and solve problems in a culture in which the only solidarity we're seeing, the primary solidarity, is coming from the capitalist class. You know, so I'm not sure that there's such a radical shift from 2016 to 2020 to 2024. It's a failure of the Democratic Party. And even under Biden, the Democratic Party actually pivoted a little bit toward labor in a way that the Harris campaign did not.
Well, I'd like to go to former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner, who we spoke to last week. She served as co-chair of independent Senator Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign.
I think over time, the Democratic Party lost its way in terms of just talking to working class voters. And I mean from all identities, because sometimes when we say working class, people assume we're just talking about white men. I'm talking about working class people from all walks of life. And my state, you know, CAFTA, NAFTA, this happened over time. It didn't just happen in one fell swoop. It happened over decade after decade after decade. But those trade deals definitely decimated Midwestern states like mine and really hurt a lot of workers. And then working class people from all backgrounds do not necessarily see themselves. They feel like elitism has taken over for both parties, but especially in the Democratic Party. And so when you don't see yourself in a party, you decide that you want to go another way. And then more recently, when I say recently, certainly over the almost 4 years, as people were suffering the effects of COVID, we're all trying to break out of it, inflation very high, the cost of groceries high, the cost of gas high, all of those material condition elements, the Democratic Party denied that, and they trotted out Bidenomics, and they turned their backs on people and made it seem as though the pain points that the big mamas and big papas were feeling were not necessarily real. You cannot do that.
So, Robin Kelly, that was Ohio State Senator Nina Turner. If you could respond to what she said and put it in the context of what you mentioned earlier, namely the absence of working class cohesion, and what that meant for this election. And why, in fact, why do you think there is an absence of cohesion among the working class in the U.S.?
Right. No, I think I totally agree with what Nina Turner said. This is where we are right now. The absence of cohesion has to do with the general two things, I think. One, the general absence of solidarity in a longstanding kind of neoliberal culture where people are taught to solve their own problems, a kind of deep individualism, and that corporate interests are the only ones, in other words, private interests are the ones that could solve your problem. Government is a problem. Government gets in the way. This is the kind of discourse that we've been seeing for at least three, four decades. And so even though we see amazing developments in the labor movement with the UAW, we see discussions and talk of solidarity, the Boeing strike, for example. But in terms of those who are either unorganized or at the sort of edges of a concierge economy that is no longer based in high-wage manufacturing, what ends up happening is almost impossible to organize people and to think as a class. And, you know, the Amazon strike in Bessemer is a really good example of what could have been, but how the combination of fear, insecurity, and the failure to really think of solidarity, in other words, to care for our neighbor, to care for those who are not us, but maybe we share the same class, that sense of solidarity that Audre Lorde talks about at the beginning of my piece, that's missing. And we haven't done the work, the political education work, to build that sense of cohesion. But the other thing that I think is really important is this belief that we could one day become Trump. In other words, wealth, entrepreneurship, this striving for success, the fact that a lot of these Senate campaigns, these you know, where seats were overturned, they were won by billionaires and millionaires. You know, I mean, that's significant. And one other thing I should add is that, you know, we could look at this at the presidential level. We could also look at the local level. I'm here in L.A. In what's supposed to be the left coast, California, where we just had propositions that failed, a proposition to end prison, forced prison labor, a proposition to raise the minimum wage, a proposition for rent control, you know, a proposition that actually, the one proposition that did win was one that was deeply criminalized and extend sentences for petty crimes. This is in L.A. You see, this is California. So we're moving towards the right, and somehow the right for many people is attractive, and we have to figure out why it's attractive. And if we don't think of ourselves as a class with power, a class in which the state could be the lever of equality rather than deep inequality, then we're going to be stuck supporting Trumps for the rest, for generations.
Yeah, it's very interesting on the issue of prison labor and the ballot initiative there. When we were out in California interviewing prisoner firefighters who got a pittance a day, they were pushing for earlier release, but they didn't get it often because it provided a prisoner labor force for the wildfires that plague California. But I wanted to ask you about the extremism of Trump when he was talking about, or, you know, at the Madison Square Garden rally, of course, that Puerto Rico is an island of garbage. He would later call that whole rally a love fest, you know, referring to women as the B word, and of course, how he deals with immigrants. But there's a very interesting comment of writer Meg Inderti, who tweeted, "If you're someone who is able to overlook the genocide and cast a vote for Kamala Harris, then you already understand how a conservative was able to overlook Trump's extremism to vote for him." Can you comment on this? Robin Kelly, you talk a lot about the working class and the working poor. You also have written extensively about Gaza.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, one of the questions that came up, my students were posing this question to me the other day. What would have happened had the U.S. actually stopped supporting Israel, like in November or December of last year? What would have happened? I think the Democrats could have won. You know, we overestimate the power of the Israeli lobby, and because in some ways Democrats are looking for dollars, not necessarily votes. And so imagine what would have happened had there been this refusal to send arms to Israel. There would be the war would have ended. There wouldn't be an escalation of the war. And part of the attraction of Trump, ironically, is this belief, this kind of a myth, but still this belief that under Trump there were no wars, you know. And so here we have possibly three different wars going on at once under the Democrats. And you could see how that would generate some fear. But to go back to the question of the extremism and elites, you know, toxic masculinity is a huge factor. The buildup coming from state right-wing state legislatures to attack the curriculum, to attack DEI, to attack, you know, trans people at every single level. Here we are dealing with an extremism that is actually palpable, and that I could see how some elites on the right, those who actually have drafted Project 2025, would support these policies. So in some ways, what we keep calling fascism, which I agree is fascism, is pretty mainstream among the Project 2025 people, pretty mainstream among the MAGA Republicans. And the Republican Party is a MAGA party. whatever the old bourgeoisie of the kind of older neoliberal order, whatever they think, they're either going to go with the program or they're going to do what they did, support Harris and Waltz. And that didn't work out for them. So, I mean, I'm actually terrified by a future in which the kind of violence of the settler colonial mentality, which was always there, has escalated and become normalized in a way. And let's remember that the history of fascism is filled with supporters who themselves are targets of fascism. We have examples of that, you know, historically. So, you know, it's hard to